Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in Landscape Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And today, I have a special guest for you. Her name is Jane Hutton. She is a landscape architect and assistant professor at the School of Architecture at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. The book is Reciprocal Landscapes: Stories of Material Movements. So Jane, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with, could you tell the audience your motivation for writing this book?
Sure. I think the motivation for this book comes from when I was practicing and specifying materials in landscape architecture and really just having so many questions about where everything was coming from and finding it really interesting to learn about the sources, but also finding it difficult to find that information. And so, you know, at the most basic level, the book is about trying to see construction materials as more than products for a single use and trying to think about them as connected to forests and quarries and factories and workers and landfills and all of the other spaces and landscapes that they make up in their lifetime.
And so how is the book structured? How do you approach the subject?
So the book is structured, there's five chapters, and each chapter follows a different construction material and each of these construction materials ended up in a important public landscape in New York City. And so I basically traced that material back to where it, you know, one of the places that it came from. And then the chapter is about trying to find links between this faraway, distant, usually kind of unknown material source and then the place where it ended up. And these chapters span over the last 150 years. So the earliest chapter starts in the late 19th century. So thinking about Central Park and the fertilizers that were used in the original construction of it. And then the most recent chapter is about tropical hardwood or ipé lumber that was used in the High Line in, you know, 2009.
So what are you, I'll just start with the introduction. You've got materials in motion. So what are materials in motion and how does that relate to landscape projects? What do you hope that people take away from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the aim is to, or for me, you know, my personal aim is to try to think about materials not as in one state, or to try to think about materials not just as commodities, not just as things that we buy, but that they are actually connected to other places, that they've been other places, that they have their own inherent values apart from the way we might want to use them. So that section, Materials in Motion, is about trying to, setting up the book to follow these trajectories or these different paths that these materials take.
And what paths, what kind of paths do they take? How, I didn't think about it before. I was reading your book and, all we do is just shift. We're just shifting everything around.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was something that I like thinking about is not only, you know, people are shifting materials around, but everything is, you know, everything is moving. If you think about mountains moving and erosion and all of the constant flow of materials. And so I think in the book, I'm trying to think about human directed material flow. So the buying and selling and extracting and exploiting and tending of landscapes and the moving of materials in that regard, but also the way in which, you know, all matter is moving on its own, you know, for its own purposes as well.
Okay. So in your first, you've got, five material movements traced in this book. Let's start with, you said Peru to Central Park. How did Peru get in Central Park?
So Peru, so it's actually a very, very small trace material, small amount of Peruvian guano, which is dried bird poop, that was specified. So Olmsted, when he's setting out the original spec for the lawns in Central Park, some of the lawns in Central Park, he's using a whole bunch of different soil amendments. There is a lot of composted horse manure. You know, the whole city is covered in horse manure at the time, so there's lots of that. There's night soil, so human manure that's being composted in the park and then being used to fertilize the soils. But there's also a lot of other things being used, including new, more processed and purchased and kind of mineralized fertilizers. And one of those that's starting to gain popularity in the broader, like, so I guess another thing that's happening at the time is farms are expanding. There's kind of the industrialization of farms, which are responding to larger urban populations. And so those farms start to apply and experiment with much more a higher potency, more stable fertilizers besides, you know, beyond farm manures. And one of those that starts to take hold is guano. And one of the major sources for global guano was this archipelago called the Chinches Islands off of coastal Peru. And so at this time, there becomes a very dominant trade of Peruvian guano to North, kind of urbanizing North American regions, but also Europe. And it's, you know, a very small amount of this guano is used in Central Park, but I included it in the book because I think it's a really critical moment in which the whole notion of a metabolic cycle within a city and within a farm is radically changing. And Olmsted's on the cutting edge, and he is thinking about farming in general. He's wanting to experiment with everything, you know, that's available. So he uses it as well.
Oh yeah. I didn't realize it till I saw the pictures in your book. I guess, you know, just in our day and age, Rita, we grew up in the age of cars that you had those streets with all the horse manure on it. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. There were piles and piles of manure all over the place. And so literally big parts of the park were being used as places to deposit excess manure.
And at night too. So this is creating quite a landscape in New York City too, that they're like rearranging, and people made a living out of moving, let's always say, poop around.
Yeah. So this is kind of pre household plumbing. And so what I think is really interesting about this time for someone looking at it, you know, from our time, is the fact that at that moment, you know, people were a lot more comfortable and used to the idea that poop was useful, you know, that it was part of soil fertility. And so it was really commonly understood that people would be removing human manure, and it would be being brought to the periphery or being processed into what they called poudrette, you know, kind of mixed with some clay and dried up and made into a powerful fertilizer. And it was just this moment when the city is really expanding and there's a lot more urban waste, you know, of all kinds. And a lot of it was kind of very obvious that you would try to do something with it that was productive and that would be tied to local organic cycles, which I think is pretty, you know, it still happens in lots of ways, but it's pretty far from our urban imaginations today.
Yeah, especially that. It's like, huh, wow. I wonder what the city smelled like back then.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to imagine. Yeah. We think it smells bad now. I can't imagine what it was back then. Okay, so let's go from Granite, from Maine to Broadway. How does rock move around?
Yeah, so that chapter takes place in the 1890s, and it's about, you know, at that moment in time, there's a lot of emphasis on the hardening of the streets of Manhattan. There's an idea that the, you know, repaving is going to allow for capital to flow more smoothly. And so there's a lot of reinvestment in hardening and kind of smoothening the surfaces of the street. And so at the same time, there's also a lot of really important government buildings, sculptures, kind of noble, you know, urban artifacts being constructed. And granite is the best, you know, best, most plentiful, most beautiful material that everybody wants to specify, including for paving. And so a lot of this granite is coming from New England quarries, and quite a lot is coming from Maine. And so in this chapter, I'm looking at Vinyl Haven in the Fox Islands, and which is an archipelago that's really, you know, right in the water. And so there's a really convenient, or it's very easy to quarry the stone and get it right into boats as they're going down the Atlantic seaboard. And so tons of material was leaving Maine and heading to many cities, but also New York. And this chapter looks at specifically the labor kind of agreements and disruptions that occur over granite. So at the time, the granite workers in Maine were were kind of the center point of organizing to create a granite cutters union, and which was the first in the States. And the chapter talks about an event in 1892 when there is essentially a lockout and strike in Maine, and it discusses the kind of solidarity movement of workers in New York City who were paving layers and different people associated with constructing the streets who essentially strike in solidarity with the Maine quarry workers. So in some ways, the chapter is about the way in which labor solidarity is kind of expressed over space.
Now, why did they decide to start doing granite? Was it for aesthetic reasons? Was it for cars? What was it for?
It was for aesthetics, but also kind of smoothness. You know, there was a real idea that the bumpy roads, I mean, it's kind of described as, right, there's actually a photo in the book or a drawing in the book showing people on carriages kind of getting bumped all around, and there was this idea that the bumpy road was not suitable for a kind of major capital or a major, you know, center of urban delights, and that it was kind of distasteful for people visiting, and we needed more order in the city, and we needed more we needed things, kind of goods and services, to be able to be moved more smoothly. So there is a, you know, a strong and persistent idea that infrastructure is really directly tied to economic well-being. And so that was one of the motivators, I think, that made that be a time of repaving and kind of focus on the smoothening of the streets.
I guess it's kind of like the shocks in our cars now. We expect a smooth ride now, but yeah, that would, yeah. Okay, now you got carriages going over manure and it's like bumpy, yeah. And I'm like,
yeah, exactly. Smooth it out. Yeah.
Boy, I'm kind of glad I live in 2020. Okay, so steel. Now, what is steel? How they extract it from the environment? Why was it important? You've got it from Pittsburgh to Riverside Park.
Yeah, so here, I'm looking at steel that was used to cover the open tracks in Riverside Park as in the 1930s as part of the renovation of Riverside Park. And I'm focusing on the Cary furnaces in Pittsburgh, which was the blast furnaces that are processing material for U.S. steel that's coming from all over the place, but especially or from Minnesota and limestone and coking coal from Pennsylvania. And the chapter looks at both the Cary furnaces and Riverside Park are both right on major rivers. And so it kind of looks at their evolution side by side. One as in Pittsburgh as a really central industrial riverfront, and then in Riverside Park as a space that's starting to become more gentrified and more focused, kind of deindustrialized and more focused towards recreation.
Oh, well, so with steel, I mean, would you focus in the book on any like environmental consequences of these materials?
Yeah. So one of the things that you see if you look at these two rivers, so the Monongahela River versus the Hudson River, is that as, you know, in the same moment in the century in Pittsburgh, as the steel really starts to crescendo and become a major industry, the water quality of the river is really, really atrocious. And that only later in the century, when a lot of the steel works shut down, does the air, you know, people start to see the air and the water clearing up. And so maybe that's, at least in the book, that's one of the registers of the steel industrial kind of impact on the immediate environment.
Yeah. Did you find in your material movements, did you study the impacts of like all this moving material around and, you know, the environmental and monetary and, you know, is it worth it to move around all these materials?
I mean, I think it's hard to say what's worth it necessarily. I mean, I think you can, as a whole, if you look at the last century or two, you know, this material movement is the basis for the economic system, for all urbanization, for all construction. You know, everything that is being built with ores from around the world, and, you know, kind of these resources that are all exploited and often from kind of limited resources. So I think we can draw, you know, you can definitely see how these patterns have produced the world that we live in now, which obviously has some really major crises in terms of, you know, climate crises, but also inequities in terms of whose homes are impacted in these global relationships of exploitation. You know, whose land is hurt, whose health is compromised, who is not compensated fairly. All of these things, I think, are, you know, they're huge realities that obviously are difficult to, I certainly I don't provide any kind of comprehensive overview of that, but I think through looking at these very specific material cases, in all of them, you see there's really very few cases that don't involve some kind of pretty intense environmental change, labor inequities,
et cetera.
Et cetera. Yeah.
Okay, so we got chapter 4 is trees from Rikers Island to 7th Avenue. So this is getting to landscape architecture. What about the trees?
So the trees. So this chapter looks at, so this is around the late 1950s, and it's a moment of time in the city when there's a lot of municipal disinvestment. The chapter looks at a community-driven major tree planting in on 7th Avenue north of Central Park in Harlem. And the trees that are supplied by the city are coming from a Parks Department nursery on Rikers Island, which for a few decades was producing the majority of street trees, street tree nursery stock for the entire city. And was a kind of plan when Rikers Island was being developed as a large penitentiary complex. It was a plan that Robert Moses cracked up with, or as kind of part of that, which was to build a large municipal nursery that would supply the city with trees to spec, you know, and the chapter focuses on the London Plane Tree because that was everybody's favorite street tree at the time. So the majority of trees being produced in the beginning were London Plane Trees. There were lots of others as well. And the idea was to produce trees that could really live on the city streets and that they would be produced very cheaply because they would be tended by unpaid incarcerated workers. And so it was kind of, you know, the city saw it as like a win-win situation. But of course there's more to that than, you know, there's more to that story as well. And I guess the short story of that is that this nursery produced tens and tens of thousands of trees that now kind of make up a lot of the mature canopy of the city.
Oh, wow. How beautiful. So now we've kind of gone from, yes, smelly streets to like paved streets, and now we're bringing the forest back into the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that you really don't know, you know, there are some records of exactly which species were planted where. They don't have tags. They don't, you know, they don't necessarily say how old they are, but we know that a lot of them were produced from this island.
Well, did you find in some of these material movements, it made me think of a question. The material, you know, is it like in fashion, out of fashion, or the street trees, like you said, that people really like right now, and then they're, you know, I don't know, aesthetics change, and then they bring in something different?
Yeah, definitely. So that was one of the deciding factors for how I selected materials at certain times, because I think they, you know, they have their moment. And I guess at this, as street trees were starting to be formalized, like maybe in the 30s, or the mid-century, there was a love for this particular species because it just was so hardy and it could handle pollution and you could kind of lock a bike to it and you could, you know, kind of just had this real roughness to it. But if you are in the book, I was able to talk with the person who's in charge of street tree planting today. And now, you know, in the mid-century, there were like four favored species. Now they're growing 200, and they really, the Parks Department really thinks about the city, not just as like one type of biological condition. They think about it as many, many different ecological conditions that can support very, you know, a huge diversity of different types of trees. So that's a really huge shift in the way you might think about, or in the way people have thought about trees in cities.
Oh, well, that leads to the next one, tropical hardwood from northern Brazil to the High Line. Well, I'm here in Key Largo. We have a lot of, my favorite hardwood trees. It's a Ligum vitae tree down here in the Keys. And I was amazed at when I did some research down here to all the hardwood trees and how they're used in different places. Why and how did they take the hardwood to the High Line?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, Ipe, so it focuses on Ipe, and it really is. Ipe is just a fabulously rot resistant, super hard, you know, completely beautiful wood that, that stands out in terms of its performance in cold and wet places. And so it's really, you know, it's been a favorite type of wood for people to use for a couple decades or more. And I think what the chapter looks at is the, you know, the origin, like why, what is it about the way that tree grows, or it's actually a couple of species. What is it about the way that those trees grow that produces such amazing physical properties? And one of the, you know, some of the aspects of how those trees grow is that they're very slow growing, and they grow very sparsely. So you find them, you know, not all clumped together, but very separated. And so that, that reality. And it's also actually that, you know, the slowness of the growth that contributes to its amazing, the properties that we love, you know, like the hardness of it. It was so hard that the US government considered using it as like, you know, ball bearings. It's like really, really tough stuff. And so the chapter looks at how these really unique ecological growing conditions produce this commodity that's really loved, but also the extraction of it. You know, you can only take so much because it grows so slowly. So the installation of the IPE in that first phase of the High Line was demonstrated against by a group of climate change activists who were wanting to call out the city for encouraging or enabling the procurement of slow growing tropical hardwoods. And so they were, I guess, part of a movement of advocacy that ended up influencing the procurement practices to the point where the city has made some adjustments to their practices and are limiting the procurement of slow growing tropical hardwoods for parks projects.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, I guess it's kind of a conundrum. I guess I was thinking about, you're talking about, is that, you know, if you want a project to be durable and be sustainable, you want to use something like that, but you don't want to also, you know, strip the land of all the hardwoods either.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Exactly. I would say that the comment that you just made is something that comes up constantly in this book, but I think just generally for designers as they're specifying materials, which is that there are few very, very clear answers. You know, like there's usually a contradiction somewhere because somebody wants to choose a material that's going to last, you know, that is, making something that's going to stick around is obviously a really important agenda. And there's so many different pieces to a construction project. Like how long is it going to last? That means not only do you get to kind of maintain that material for longer in use, but all of the labor that's required to install it, all of the other, you know, kind of efforts that are required to fix something or maintain it. So I think that the fact is these questions are really, they're really complex, and they really don't lend themselves to a single best answer always. So I think my agenda is really just to get to know more, you know, to try to understand a little bit more about these materials and some of the contradictions and complexities in what it means to work with them.
Well, I guess on one note, it's like if it is more ecological to have something that lasts longer.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, there are a lot. I think that's a really important principle.
Let's go into what are some of your favorite case studies that you found with these materials?
I mean, I think I just really love the process of kind of doing the detective work, and for all of the cases, I would typically end up or like kind of start up with just a vague notion of a certain material I was interested in. And then I just had no idea where it was going to end up. I had no, you know, I just kind of follow it to see where it came from. And so I'd say maybe more than any in particular, I just really enjoy that, the unknown aspect of that research. And I guess like, you know, the Rikers Island case is an example of like, I just had no idea that I would have never been able to, it's actually not something that, it seems like is very well known, that the existence of that tree nursery. It doesn't exist anymore. In the 80s, the Rikers Island just swelled hugely with the increasing incarceration rates. And so the nursery was shut down and moved elsewhere. But I just, you know, had no clue that that existed. And even when I went to talk to the Parks Department, there were the people there who said, yeah, it's, you know, we hardly even know about this. So I like the fact that like you can pretty much look all around you wherever you're looking and kind of identify any object or any material, and it's going to lead to something kind of interesting, kind of unknown, and it will lead to another place. You know, it leads to another, looking at my couch here and the fabrics that are on my couch and starting to think about the fibers, you know, the plant or petroleum-based fibers that are in this couch, and leads me to start to think about, you know, those as actual places, those as actual landscapes. And I think that's, for me, that was the fun thought experiment of the book.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. I was just thinking, it's like, well, no matter what park you're sitting in, everything there comes from somewhere, being molded and moved around, whether it's dirt, trees, or even, yeah, benches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes there's I think one of the really interesting things about landscape architecture is that it's always a mix, or usually a mix, of things that are brought in, but also hybridized with the ground. You know, like the site is always also the design, you know, the site is always a big part of the construction. So whereas maybe in some other forms of design, or even in a lot of architecture, you're really importing or bringing materials onto a site. Whereas in landscape, you're bringing things on, but then you're mixing them up with things that are there. And I think, it gets messy and multi-layered in a really interesting way.
Do you have a favorite material?
I don't know. I mean, I love wood. It's just amazing. I think maybe one of the things that I really love about working with wood is just how it allows you to see this connection between a living being and this material. It's so alive, you know, it's like, it's moving so much. It shows you branching patterns. It shows you, it kind of reveals a lot about how it came into being, even when it's, you know, even when it's pretty domesticated into a 2x4. And that to me is like endlessly interesting.
That's true. I was just thinking, I've got a fake little desk right here with my little TV stand and for this interview. And then I've got like my real wood desk sitting here. And yeah, so all these probably interesting stories about its growth and et cetera, and probably all different places it came from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's no end to just staring at things and kind of trying to imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Who are you?
There's a story from all of it. Yeah. Well, in your studios at school, how do you use this book to teach your students about materiality and you know, its usefulness and how they're going to be using it in their future professional life?
Yeah, I've taught some classes where the students do research that's quite similar to what I did in the book. So basically they'll pick a material and trace it and try to understand the ecological impacts and history of labor associated with them. And that's been super interesting. I've learned so much from them. But I guess I've also, you know, have worked with different students who are doing independent thesis research about, you know, deconstruction materials, experimental practices of imagining, like, what if we couldn't, you know, what if we couldn't import everything? What if we really had to design and construct with what is on site? So I think, you know, some of these experiments of just looking more closely at what's already there and what can be made with it is something that I find really interesting and like to bring into teaching.
Well, in that case, yeah. Next, how can professionals maybe use this in their book and you know, talk to clients about materiality, et cetera, and use some of these stories maybe in their design?
Yeah, that's a, I'm, I'm curious. I think I think a lot of designers do. They do a lot of advocacy for, like, I think in the process of working with clients, they're often advocating for their values. And I think, whether that's to increase biodiversity or create better public space or whatever that might be. And I think, I think that, and I'm sure lots of people do this, but that it can be a powerful thing to think about material and kind of have conversations with clients about materials, not just as what they are in that moment, but also, you know, what they have been or what they will be in the future. So to really think about these different stages of life. And I think, you know, we are used to that in terms of historic preservation, or we're used to that in terms of maybe local materials, people really saying, no, we want to use these things because they're coming from nearby. So I think that's something that a lot of people are interested in right now. And I can imagine that clients that professionals work with are also more tuned into the why that's important or what kind of value that might add to their projects. One analogy that often comes up in relationship to this project is the system of slow food or local food, which is something that's so prevalent now. Everybody is used to asking, like, well, you know, where did my food come from, and what do I think about that? And so I guess it's the kind of construction or design version of that. You know, like, why does it matter? What are the impacts? What kind of, in addition to having less negative impacts, what kind of interesting ideas or relationships can you support by really thinking about the paths of the materials that you're using?
Is there anything else? Well, you could like do like a whole encyclopedia on every like material from a site.
That would be great. I have to work a little faster. it takes me a really long time. So, but yeah, I find it endlessly interesting just because there's no limit, you know, like it's like everything has a story.
Well, Gitches, is there anything else that you'd like to add about this book that you'd like the audience to know about?
I mean, I think I touched on a lot of it. I mean, I hope the audience checks it out and love to hear any comments at any time.
Yeah, I mean, you did a great job. You know, everything is, you got all the research notated and all these really like old pictures and stuff. Did you like travel through the archives to get all these old pictures?
I did a lot of archives. Yeah. And I love, actually, that was a real pleasure of this project. And kind of basically for each of these five cases, you know, there's very different arc. They're happening in different moments in time. So they have very different qualities of information or qualities of photography. You know, for example, in the 30s, the photography is like just incredible. It kind of goes downhill after that. But it's interesting to do a project that's really across time because you see such a wide range of ways that people are writing and documenting sites.
Yeah, the photographs, it's all black and white, and it's an amazing, even just kind of a cultural history of evolution and of cities too, the urban city and the rural areas.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's the point I should have said when you asked me if there were other points. I think a big part of the project is about really just trying to make clear these connections between what we think of as the urban, which is, I think, often what gets a lot of attention, especially in the design disciplines, and then the other place, which is like foggy to many of us. And so the underlying agenda was to really try to bring those close together, to try to explore the ways they're actually very linked, kind of impossible to unlink.
Yeah, just the rural and now it's becoming the urban forestry movement that's become so popular now, and how it's all just kind of meshed together.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other points you'd like to add to the book? Give me one more chance.
I think you got it.
I think so. it's a beautiful book. I tell the audience, it's a beautiful book. Just on each of these, we could talk forever about each one of these little tiny materials and where they come from and how they get used. And I was just thinking, it's like, wow, this could be like a great way to storytell a site.
Yeah. I like the way you're putting that.
So, well, Jane, thank you so much for being here today and taking the time out to be here. What are you working on now?
I'm starting to think a bit more about an aspect that is in this book. I guess it's maybe closely related to the trees chapter, which is the notion of maintenance in landscape architecture and all of the kind of human care that goes into keeping sites alive, and I guess the horticultural work of that. And so I'm thinking about that and researching about that in relationship to the notion of a just transition or a kind of post fossil fuel focused society. So that's really, just getting started, but I'm also, really interested in starting to do some work about material reuse and deconstruction. So that's where I'm at right now.
Oh, well, this is great. Yeah. I like the book and thinking about materials and just getting a start on how sites go together, et cetera. So, well, thank you so much for being here today. And again, I'll tell the audience that this book, you got to get it. It's Reciprocal Landscapes, Stories of Material Movements by Jane Hutton, published by Routledge in 2020. And I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, with a special mini-series in landscape architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And thank you for listening.